Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. As we have been hearing today, the effects of Tropical Storm Harvey are still ravaging Texas, floodwaters rising. On Monday, somebody from the Pierce County Emergency Management Department, Scott Hines, told us about some emergency responders heading from here in Washington State down to the disaster area. Well, we talked with Scott earlier today. He told us the task force was on the road for 48 hours straight, kept getting rerouted to different emergency sites, finally ended up in College Station, home of Texas A&M, where, as Hines put it, this rescue team is living in Spartan-like conditions. They slept in a barn last night. They took showers in a horse stall with a hose. And this morning, the task force headed out for the first time to actually begin administering rescue aid. So we are going to get you another update tomorrow. We'll talk about what they have encountered and who they've helped. Meanwhile, if you would like to help, NPR put together a handy list of ways to do that, so we're tweeting that list out right now at KUOW. Okay, so closer to home now, we have been trying to figure out how to deal with our own slower-moving regional crisis. The question is, how far would you go to help solve homelessness in Seattle? Would you donate to a charity? Would you volunteer at a soup kitchen? Would you build a home in your backyard where a homeless person can live? That is what my first guest wants you to do. And don't dismiss it, because he didn't just dream this up out of nothing. Rex Holbein, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having us.
You would like us to have a tiny home on every block of every residential neighborhood in Seattle. And the way you got to this plan is worth telling. It began in your bathroom.
Well, it did, in a way. So I'm an architect, and I had moved my office to the Fremont neighborhood. And during that time, this was about 7-8 years ago, I began to meet a lot of people that were homeless. And one of the things that happened for me is that who they were, who their character of person, was not matching up to the negative stereotype. And that created an internal conversation for me to challenge that. In that process, I did invite people into my office to use the bathroom. And of course, when I did that, word spread on the street immediately from Ballard to the University District. And really all day long, I had people coming, knocking to use the bathroom. And through that, I got to meet a lot of people, and really set into motion for me the next 7 years of opening myself, opening the business, and subsequently starting a nonprofit from a Facebook page that now has about 45,000 people following it to try to address the issues of homelessness.
People want to know how they can help, right? You found people want to help with homelessness, don't know how?
I think that's exactly it. I'm glad you said that, because it really is not a compassion issue. It is simply that people, when they address an issue that is so overwhelming, they have a difficult time knowing how to start. And that's actually the mission of our nonprofit, is to allow simple, easy ways for people to get involved, to tap into their own empathy, their own compassion.
But just to say a word for people not getting involved, don't we help by paying taxes to build things like emergency shelters?
Of course, yeah. And I think, you know, we're all at a different point in our journey. And if that's what you can do, and if that's where you're at, that's great. But there is so much more when we reach out beyond donating money, when we actually spend time and create a human connection. The journey actually isn't just for that person that's homeless, it's for ourselves as well.
Yeah, well, yeah. Let's talk about the human connection and what the helper, I guess, if we want to use that term, gets out of it personally. I want to just first get right at why this is hard. We asked people on KOW's Facebook page, would you put a tiny home in your backyard for a homeless person? And Robin says, definitely not, would not be comfortable with the idea. I am well aware, says Robin, that it is the politically incorrect answer, but as I see it, the odds of getting a questionable individual in your backyard are pretty high. So what is the screen?
Yeah. Well, I would say to Robin, like I would say to anybody, that we're all on this journey as we go through life. We're all opening ourselves at various times to various people, various issues. And we know that the more we open ourselves to an issue, the more we learn. And the more we learn, the more we begin to understand the complexity of that issue. And in that understanding, we open ourselves empathetically. We don't just jump into the deep end of the swimming pool before we learn to swim. We go into the, you know, into the shallow end and splash around a little bit. And we're asking people to begin to, you know, to just say hello, to make eye contact, to do what you are comfortable with, and then move that bar for yourself. So if we just ask in a vacuum, can you put a small home that is fully functional, bathroom, kitchen, sleeping, in the backyards of residential lots, I would expect the answer just in a vacuum to be no. But once you begin to open yourself to the issue and you begin to understand the process and the parts and pieces that have been put into play, such as case management, wraparound care, agencies that are involved, all of the support that's involved, it doesn't become that kind of scary thought. So
yeah, so we're going to talk about, you say this is a fully functioning little house, and we're going to talk about the size and the running water and stuff. I want to now introduce somebody also in our studio with us who overcame that. I don't know, Kim, whether you were how fearful you were of the idea, but this idea of a homeless stranger in the yard is something you're doing. You are hosting Rex's first tiny house in Beacon Hill. Kim Sherman, how did you get okay with a man named Bobby living in your backyard?
It was actually a very easy decision. I can tell you what I'm not okay with, which is having over 11,000 people living homeless in King County. And that has been a real heartbreaking concern for me, you know, for a while. And in my short walk from my home in Beacon Hill to Pioneer Square, where I work, I've seen, you know, as many as 100 homeless people just in that short distance. And I've seen tents with strollers parked outside of them. I've heard babies crying in tents. I've seen wheelchairs, people with disabilities, people with mental health issues, and they're just abandoned. And, you know, it just, that's not okay with me. And this project presented something concrete that I could be involved in that would make a difference.
How did you get over, so as Robin said, the odds of getting a questionable individual in your backyard are pretty high. So how did you get past that or never even be bothered by that idea of a stranger there?
I guess it wasn't, I mean, there are 11,643 homeless people in Seattle. There are a lot of people out there who have their own individual story, came to homelessness for a variety of reasons. And I'm not exactly sure about what questionable means exactly, but, you know, there are a lot of people who are kind and caring and, you know, really good people who have fallen on hard times, who had circumstances where they couldn't pay what is a studio apartment cost in Seattle now, $1,500 a month.
Well, Robin might think that person is priced out and maybe desperate and maybe dangerous. What people want to know, how can I be confident about a stranger? So what's the screening process?
Well, first of all, I would address just even the definition as stranger. You know, I think when we don't know anything about each other, we can make these assumptions. Some people assume beautiful things. Some people see concern. And but I think we have to allow for all of that.
What is the screening process for someone who has that question?
Yeah, so every single person that will be living in a block home in the backyard of a residential lot will have to come through a case management agency. So for instance, we're working currently with Chief Seattle Club, Sophia Way, and Mary's Place. All of those case management services will be brought to bear for anybody that is gonna be living in a block home. So we're not just putting somebody in a backyard like Kim and Dan's and saying, good luck. You know, we want that person to succeed. We want them to move out of homelessness and become a healthy, important part of community that can be supported like we all are in community.
Okay, more to say here. Maybe we should describe this home. Give me the picture. How big? What's it look like? What's inside it?
Sure. So the home basically is 125 square feet. It's small. It is completely...
That's like 11 by 11 feet.
Roughly.
Yeah.
It's 16 feet long by about 9. It has a covered porch. does not include that. That's not included in the 125 square feet. But this home is designed to be completely off-grid, and that means that all of its power comes from solar collectors, all of its water from rain catchment. That water is contained in a cistern, purified, and even used for drinking water. And all of the waste is taken care of locally on the site, meaning that there's a composting toilet and there is subsurface irrigation for the shower and the sink.
Okay, you're getting at what maybe the biggest, most common question we got on Facebook, which was, does this backyard house have running water? Are they going to be able to take a shower? Is there a toilet?
So yes, absolutely. On the health department side, we are still in process for getting completely off-grid. In other words, being able to take care of the waste on site. But that is coming from the top down, from Patty Hayes, the director of the health department, King County. They want to see this happen, but they have to obviously go through their own checklist to approve it. Currently in Kim and Dan's yard, the home is completely powered by solar energy and is hooked up to their sewer and their water.
Okay, so it's small. So if someone who's thinking, what about all the space in my yard this will take up? It's 125 feet square. And Kim, how did you get to know Bobby? And where is he? The health department hasn't signed off on this now. Where is Bobby now? How'd you get to know him?
We met Bobby through Chief Seattle Club, which is one of the social service agencies that Facing Homelessness is working with in the Block Project. And I think the process was a little different for us because we're first, but we just talked to the agency and talked about what kind of a neighbor would work well for us. We're fairly introverted folks. We tend to not be very loud, so that was, you know, could be a concern for some people if they have issues with noise. My partner is a musician, so we looked for points of connection and somebody who would be a good personality fit.
So the personality, you're introverted, so that it's better if this person is not very talkative toward you?
I don't think it's not talkative, but we were just looking for a personality fit, like you would with any new friend, acquaintance.
But what's that for you?
Well, the person that is moving in, Bobby, is really fun. He's just a sweet man. He's 75 years old. He has been homeless for about a decade. He's very kind and generous, and he's got a great sense of humor. So he ended up being a great fit. He's also a musician, amateur musician, has played guitar and harmonica, and
that helps.
Yeah, so that's it's a point of connection. I like to garden. He likes to garden.
Okay.
So it was a good fit.
Rex, is this a matter partly of social skills? Because what if somebody would like to live in a tiny house in someone's backyard, but they don't have the smoothest social presentation?
Well, I think, you know, there's a fit for everyone, right? I mean, we all meet friends in our lives, and I think what Kim is articulating, one thing she left out that I want to add is that Kim and Dan have been volunteering at Chief Seattle Club as well, just to continue to get to know Bobby better, and quite honestly, to better understand Native American culture. All of this is meant to try to create relationship, and Bobby and Dan and Kim have become fast friends, which is a testament to really to this, I think, to the project, but also to their efforts of wanting to make this happen.
Kim, how do your Beacon Hill neighbors feel about Bobby, and what do they know?
The folks we've talked to have been really positive. We've talked to all of our neighbors on our block. We were a little nervous about it. We don't know some of them very well, but we went around and knocked on everybody's doors, and the folks that weren't home, we left them information, and we've had only positive feedback.
Wow. You brought your neighbors into this, even neighbors you didn't know well. What did you say? You left them a note? What was your pitch?
Our pitch was that we were going to be building a small house in our backyard to provide housing for somebody who doesn't have housing.
We're not asking permission. We're letting you know this is happening.
Well, the way the Block Project works, if anybody had had objections, we would have tried to work through them. But if they had kept those objections, we wouldn't have done the project. We want people to be on board. We don't want to add trauma to the person to either the neighbor or the person who's been experiencing homelessness. We want this to be a community project.
You know, what's interesting to me is someone who might feel like Robin, who we introduced earlier, who is wary of this idea of a tiny home for someone in your yard, but doesn't want to be the openly politically incorrect jerk. And we'll see what that's going to be like for them. Do you know, have you thought about that?
I don't feel like the reactions we've gotten have been any thinly veiled dissent. Everybody has been very positive. Neighbors have come by wanting to see the progress on the house. It's been really, really positive.
You both are so natural about this, so positive. You're in that world. I was approaching this as the idea of, okay, how am I going to describe this to listeners who are thinking, like Robin, heck no. I mean, they're just, what if the person is, this person is safe and whatever acceptable means to that homeowner, but they're in a home instead of an apartment because they don't want to live with a stranger. I have an au pair from China living with me, and people say to me, how do you do that? Just how do you have a stranger in your midst? That's awkward for a lot of people.
I think it's important also to realize that this project is not for everyone. Not for every person that owns a home, and it's also not for every person that's homeless.
But you said you'd like to see one on every block or in every residential neighborhood in Seattle.
Yeah, we would like to take the bulk of the homeless crisis as a burden off of the available housing options and the social service agencies that are in place. If we do that, and right now, let's be clear, all of those agencies are stressed out. They're all overworked. They're all underfunded. We have a crisis here, and we're not meeting the need, not by a long shot. So if the Block Project can take the bulk of that weight out of the formula, then you can take all of the people that do this for a living professionally, right up and down the line from housing to mental health to drug dependency to all of it, then they can more accurately, more effectively do their job because there are a lot of people on the street who got there for reasons that are not too different that would affect any one of us. You know, it could be a loss of a job or a divorce or some medical occurrence. So we have to open ourselves to people that are in severe crisis that honestly, really, if we're being open about this, could happen to any one of us. I think that's where we begin to kind of see this issue differently, that they're not all this big scary issue of, you know, the which really is what is the negative stereotype, right? We are seeing all of these 11,643 people in this county as a group and defined often by that negative stereotype, when in fact that's not true. People have their own stories and their own very real reasons why they came to homelessness.
That's Rex Holbein, an architect and the founder of Facing Homelessness and the leader of the Block Project.
Yep, I'm going to throw in that Jennifer Lafreniere, my daughter, also a partner in Block Architects, equally involved in designing and putting this project forward.
And Kim Sherman, your final word, you called yourself an enthusiastic guinea pig. Right? Did I get that right? Maybe someone said that about you. Anyway, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, sure. Why not?
I can live with that label. Okay,
you'll roll with it. What is your pitch? What's your final word to people listening to you now about how you go from someone who's like most of us, concerned, taxpaying, maybe donating of money, of sleeping bags, of help? What do you say to someone about what it takes to become the host of someone in your yard in a 125 square foot home?
For me, it was a really easy decision to make. So maybe I was at that point in my journey, as Rex was saying. But the project is really well set up and really well thought out. So Dan and I, our role is just to provide the space and to be good neighbors. So to address Robin's concern about somebody that she's not comfortable with, we don't need to be social workers. We don't need to be case managers. We don't need to be healthcare providers. There's somebody who is in that role, who's a professional, who can provide all those needs. So really all we need to do is provide a little space and be good neighbors. So it doesn't feel like a very high bar. for somebody to get to.
Provide a little space and be a good neighbor. Kim Sherman and Rex Holbein describing the Block Project coming to Seattle. We'll see how far it spreads. And I want to thank both of you for coming in and telling us about it.
Bill, thank you for giving us this opportunity.
Thanks for having us.
Last year, we talked with a couple in Shoreline who built a homeless camp in their backyard. They shared their small house and backyard with a dozen people, including kids. You might be interested in their story. We're going to tweet out a link to that right now, at KUOW. Diversity, equity, accessibility. These are just a few front-of-mind issues for political leaders right now. They're also on the front burner at local arts organizations. The Seattle Repertory Theater has a new initiative designed to make theater by, of, and for the citizens of this city. It's called Public Works Seattle. KOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman tells you about it.
It's another hot summer day in Seattle, but that doesn't seem to bother the crowd at the Ballard Senior Center.
Hello, friends! Welcome! Hello, hello, hello!
Mariah C. Kaminsky is Associate Artistic Director for Seattle Repertory Theater, the REP. She's at the Senior Center today to lead auditions for the REP's upcoming production of The Odyssey. These seniors have spent months in a weekly musical theater workshop. Now, one by one, aspiring thespians strut their stuff. They sing, dance, recite poetry, and tell stories.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ken Parms.
Ken Parms is a big man with a voice to match. He launches into a tale set at a Seattle bus stop.
I got my pass out, got ready, took a few steps to get out of that bus shelter, and then I heard, I looked over Jordan. And what did I see? Coming for to carry me home.
Parm's performance is a big hit with his fellow seniors. He actually discovered this program by chance.
The woman that lives in my building was talking about it, and I said, oh, that sounds like fun. And she said, you know, if you pay $3, you can get a lunch. So I said, well, great, let's go, I'll drive.
The Ballard Senior Center is one of five Seattle nonprofits that partnered with the REP for Public Works Seattle's inaugural season. Over 9 months, the participants saw every show in the REP's artistic season, and they all attended weekly theater workshops tailored to the specific community group. The seniors worked on musical theater skills. At the Boys and Girls Club, participants wrote their own plays. In June, everyone got to audition for The Odyssey. Mariah C. Kaminsky says there's a reason why the REP chose this particular play.
The Odyssey is all about trying to find and get home. And certainly that is a value that we are trying to cultivate in the room. How do we make this home for everybody? How are we going to make it home for the audience?
80 community members were cast as the ensemble. Ken Parms will be featured as a Cyclops, and he's thrilled.
Like a schoolgirl, who could not be giddy?
The public works concept was developed by New York's Public Theater in 2013. Mariah C. Kaminsky and project manager Simone Hamilton worked closely with the staff there to adapt the model to Seattle. They're convinced this collaborative process of theater making can help the REP open its doors to new audiences. Hamilton says they'll never forget their first experience with live theater.
This space and this process so far and this program has provided a lot of firsts for people, not just in the ensemble, but on staff. Everybody who touches this comes in some sort of first, whether it's first time working on a show with this many people, first time ever being in a rehearsal room. You don't forget your first.
The experience has had just as big an impact on veteran theater artist Mariah C. Kaminsky.
I have these decades of theater experience behind me, and I have this big heart for this city. And to be able to serve both of those things, to use those tools to get to know the city better and to be changed myself, that's quite a reward every day.
Kaminsky says Seattle Repertory Theater will launch a new season of Public Works Seattle workshops this winter. Meanwhile, the REP presents four free performances of The Odyssey next weekend. In Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News. Welcome, welcome.
Marcy's going to host a post-show conversation about Public Works Seattle next Saturday afternoon, right after the matinee performance of the Odyssey. And you can find out more at KUOW.org/frontrowcenter. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to stay in the world of theater now. Our next guest, Sarah Porkolab, was a child when she noticed a strange tattoo on her grandma. And when she asked about it, her grandma said, "I'll explain it when you're older, Sarah." So years later, Sarah, you're searching the internet about this tattoo, and you made a discovery that your small Filipina grandma was a gangster?
That's correct.
And this is this story is at the center of your one-woman musical, which opens at Jones Playhouse at University of Washington next week. Sarah Porkolab, thank you for taking a break from rehearsals to tell us what you mean by your grandma was a gangster.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. What it means that my grandmother was a gangster, I think that we have pretty clear visual ideas around what a gangster is, somebody who's very powerful, often uses violence as part of their livelihood. Also somebody who is using their power potentially for things that are not falling in the lines of like what's good for the public. My grandmother tells a series of stories about her past. These stories change depending on who she's talking to in the family and her specific mood.
Mm-hmm.
But through my research and also just my life with her these last 28 years, I've discovered and investigated a through line with all of these stories. And what's clear to me is that my grandmother's past was filled with some pretty exciting adventures and some also really dramatic, intense, and traumatic experiences, which was motivation for her to immigrate to America.
How did you get at all this through a tattoo?
Well, the tattoo was the beginning, and then it took about 15 years to get the rest.
Okay. How did your grandmother come to be a gangster?
Well, that's a great question. I don't want to give too much away because
okay.
I'd love you to come see my show.
I like that. We can leave people wanting more.
Perfect.
Well, then let me ask, were you completely surprised?
No.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I was surprised that I wasn't more surprised.
Uh-huh.
I have memories as well as my mother's generation, my aunts and my uncles. They have memories of my grandmother, who's 5'1", flipping and taking down grown men. My grandmother was a single mom of 5 children, so she had to work all the time, was hardly ever home. My mother, as the eldest sibling, was the surrogate mom to my aunts and my uncles. And their stories of their childhood really focus on survival and the idea that when my grandmother was present, which was pretty rare, she was doing some pretty badass things, protecting them primarily and standing up for herself and her family.
Now, I'm being a little, lighthearted about, you know, we had this idea, well, there's a little old lady gangster, but I'm guessing this is not a happy story, right? That there is pain involved.
I think that every story, especially when it comes to family, is incredibly nuanced and complex. And at the intersection of those things, beauty and tragedy, hilarity and tragedy and trauma, is really where the stories are born from. So the answer is yes. There's quite a bit of pain and the process of healing as well from that pain and how that is shared and passed down to different generations is also a huge part of my show, Dragon Lady.
And why in this show, Dragon Lady, why are you bringing that to an audience? What does that have to do with your grandmother's past and your family past? What does it have to do with your audience?
It's a great question. I will try to be succinct. I'll start kind of generally the scope of why I'm doing theater in the first place. I come from a family of artists. My grandmother was a singer in the Philippines. All of the people in my family are incredibly artistically talented. Because we grew up brown and poor in white America, opportunities to pursue our passion as well as the lack of privilege really were huge obstacles. So I'm really the first person in my family to go to college to pursue this type of craft. And I realized as I was in my undergrad program that art isn't only a form of self-expression, but rather it can be a vehicle
for social change, specifically my personal artistic mission as a woman, as a person of color. I use my art to amplify and create space for specifically women and people of color, because I find that in the mainstream entertainment narrative, film, literature, and theater, that representation is lacking.
Seattle is such an Asian town. Are there not lots of roles for Asian American actors, lots of stages for Asian American art in Seattle, or less than we think?
Less than we think.
Yeah. And, why is that?
In terms of a theater town, Seattle's rather small. There are advantages to that. As an independent artist, you can move pretty easily between the walls of theaters and across the different status. For example, you have Fringe and you have your larger regional houses. Someone like me could work in Fringe and can work in a regional house. I'm not sure if I'd be able to do that in New York or Chicago. Because it's small, that already impacts how much opportunity there is. And when we think about the institutions that do have a platform to provide opportunity to actors of color, specifically Asian artists, those people in positions of power often don't take that into deliberate consideration in the planning of their seasons and the structuring of their programming.
Your show, again, Sarah, is called Dragon Lady,
right,
which I associate with, Asian women, usually older women who are powerful and secretive.
Yeah, that association makes complete sense. The term was really coined and infiltrated the mainstream in the 1930s in printed material, specifically comics and propaganda about the, I'm doing in quotes, East, the Oriental East.
Yes.
And Dragon Lady is a racial slur. A lot of people don't think about it that way because it doesn't hold the same weight, say, as the N-word. And that's because in terms of the Asian community, the type of oppression that we experience at the hands of white supremacy is very different than black people. That said, it is still a racial slur. And it's also, in my early journey of becoming an artist, I realized that the roles that were available to me either fell into the category of the Dragon Lady or the Madame Butterfly from Puccini's opera.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the opposite of the Dragon Lady, somebody who was passive,
helpless.
Somebody helpless, exactly.
Yeah.
And as I was trying to figure out, what am I going to say as an artist? What do I believe in? What's important to me? What do I want to use my art as a vehicle for? Oh, social change. Fantastic. Specifically, who for? What can I focus on? Awesome. People who look like me. Other women of color. Little girls who grew up in poor communities who want to be on stage but don't see themselves represented. And then I looked at my family because I was like, if I got to figure out who I am and what I have to say, then I need to know where I came from. And that's really how Dragon Lady was born. And I named it Dragon Lady, one, because my grandmother is powerful and secretive, but also as a way to really reclaim the narrative and to reclaim the term and then to define it completely with my own agency.
Then how are you defining Dragon Lady again?
You'll have to come see my show.
Yeah, good, good. You said the show is part love letter and part resistance.
Yes.
Is that what you mean? How is this resistance?
Totally. So let's talk a little bit now about the political climate, specifically here in America. I can only speak as an American, only ever having lived here. And I can say with confidence that our nation is a white supremacist nation. It was stolen from indigenous people and built on the backs of slaves. Where we are now politically with what's happening, everything that happened in Charlottesville, what's happening, why Black Lives Matter became a movement, what is happening now with immigration law, is the culmination of our history as a white supremacist nation. Once I became aware of the political, social, cultural, economic constructs that are influenced and held up by white supremacy, I was then able to articulate my experience outside of that narrative, because I had only ever seen myself represented as other and as minority, because that was within the construct of white supremacy. So now my story is resistance, because I am completely, I am I am denying, no, denying's not a good word. I am refuting basically the narratives that are projected onto me, as well as creating new narratives. It's a form of resistance as well, because the people who are meant to see this show are not the people who normally patronize theater, or the people who are really serviced by the theater community.
I want you to be very selfish for a moment.
Sure.
When you talk about a refuting a story, what do you think that story, what story do you think America has about you? How do you feel that?
Yeah, as an Asian woman, I think that, and also as somebody who presents, I mean, very obviously female and short in stature, that people have an idea that I'm cute, I'm passive, I'm agreeable, amenable, that I am not direct, that I am not demanding, that I am not aggressive. I am, in fact, all of those things. All of those things influence each other in very complex and nuanced ways that only I can embrace, if that makes sense. And when I say I, only because I speak for myself, right?
Can you tell me a story of how you felt that?
Yeah, sure. So I often do voiceover. I do voiceover for clients, and clients listen to my reel. So
voiceover meaning you're the voice of a commercial or an animated.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh, yeah. And so the clients pick my reel out of a selection of reels, and they don't see my face attached to the voice. So then I secure the job, and then I meet them, because they're normally there in the studio when I go in to record, and it never fails. It never fails that my client is generally an older white man over a certain age who looks at me, starts, and pulls back in surprise and goes, "Oh." And I'm like, "I'm the voice." They're like, "Oh, I didn't expect you to..." And there's always that trailing sentence. And I know what they want to say. I didn't expect you to be Asian. I didn't expect you to be this and that. But I can tell that there's a perception there. And so when they actually see me, what I represent as a body, as a political body, is surprising and disarming to them. And that's a pretty mild experience.
And what does it say to you?
It says to me that that we are not a post-racial society.
Can I ask you about white nationalists then?
Like, yeah.
I ask everybody about that these mm-hmm. days. What is your take on this American moment?
I think it's incredibly crucial. I think it is impossible to ignore. And anyone who ignores it, denies that it is happening, or tries to normalize it, is complicit in systems of oppression. Systems of oppression that affect people of color, people who do not identify as male or present as male, people who are poor, differently abled. It affects these people disproportionately. And we need to do something about it. To normalize white nationalism, to normalize the alt-right, to normalize Nazis marching in the street, I don't know. If people don't forget, like if people forget that the Holocaust happened, it wasn't that long ago. And it's not only the people marching in the street who proclaim themselves as Nazis that allow the atrocities against humanity to happen. It's the people who sit in their homes, who remain largely unaffected by those people, and who can say that they're a good person, that they're not a racist, and as long as they smile at the black woman with her black child in the grocery store, they're not responsible for white cops brutalizing black men. And it's scary.
Sarah Porkalob, we started with a grandmother and a tattoo, which is the kind of the story that's at the center of your one-woman show, Dragon Lady, and it's premiering at Jones Playhouse on the University of Washington campus September 7th.
Yes.
Show runs through October 1st. Sarah Porkalob, writer, actor, co-curator at Intimon Theater, thanks for joining us. telling us some, but not most, of your grandmother's story, because we want to know more. And thanks for talking about the moment that this country is in, that we're all in together. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
KUOW's The Record, back in just a moment. In fact, we're going to talk about the white nationalism argument that they're having, not just in the United States, but 100 or so miles away just across the border. So stay tuned. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. So we're just talking a moment ago about white nationalists and how they want to preserve monuments to American history, including our racist history. This is not just an American issue. From British Columbia, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer joins us. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
There is a man who's on your roads, on your bridges, on your buildings, on your $10 bill. Why do some Canadians want to remove Sir John A. Macdonald from all of those things?
Because in addition to being our first prime minister and in many ways the founder of the whole country and pulling us together into one piece, he was also the prime minister under whom there was some travesties, some serious trampling of the rights of the Indigenous people of Canada. The establishment of residential schools, which sounds like a harmless name, but in fact what it involved was taking Native children away from their families and their traditional lands and territories and plunking them down into church-run schools so that we could train them to be ordinary Canadians instead of, to use the awful word that the John Macdonald used, savages.
Mm-hmm.
So he's associated with that, and Canada's First Nations people, our Indigenous people, are saying that we should stop honoring somebody who was engaged in such a thing, particularly take his name off schools, because, you know, that's where you're teaching young Native people today, and you're naming the school after a guy who took them away from their own families and culture, subjected them, put them in schools where they were subjected to abuse. The Ontario Elementary School Teachers Association agrees that the names should come off the school buildings at least. And the debate has spilled over here in the provincial capital of British Columbia in Victoria, because if you come to Victoria, if you go to our City Hall, there's a big statue of John A. Macdonald outside City Hall. It's there because Macdonald is the prime minister who met British Columbia's conditions for joining Canada, which is he arranged for the building of a national railway out here. But, of course, it's an issue here as well, so the City Council in Victoria is considering whether or not to relocate the statue or just remove it altogether.
And Vaughn, as one gauge of the backlash, if you want to call it that, one of Canada's major newspapers, the Globe and Mail, called the removing of Sir John Macdonald, quote, an absurd idea, insulting to our history and to the intelligence of Canadians.
Yeah, that's been the reaction, and I think, you know, I guess the only thing I could say to Americans is if the debate over Confederate statues were to spread to the idea of removing George Washington.
Which we have discussed here, yes, in Washington State.
Renaming your state,
yeah,
or your capital, then because he owned slaves, then I think you might get some sense of the reaction here. I mean, it's a healthy discussion. I don't think it's unreasonable that once in a while you revisit these issues and you put things into perspective. But the idea of going back 150 years and saying, no, because this guy had some objectionable views, we should take him off the currency is going too far. I think the more sensible commentary, Bill, has been we should use this as a teachable moment. And I think in a constructive way, we're doing that, or at least trying to.
And Vaughn, on a separate topic, we've been reporting on the escape of, we don't know, 100,000 or so farmed Atlantic salmon near the San Juan Islands, and it sounds like they have emigrated.
Yes. Now, let me make this clear to you, Bill. These are illegal entrants into Canada.
Yeah.
They are undocumented.
Yeah.
These fish are crowding our fish out of their habitat. They are breeding indiscriminately and spreading disease. And I think the only reasonable thing we can do here in Canada is to build a wall and you people should pay for it.
I see. A seawall, and the Americans will pay for it. And will you
it's a serious problem.
Yes, yes. We have
joking aside.
Yeah, we've got in a minute and a half, Vaughn, will you remind us what the concern is here?
Yeah, I mean, these are Atlantic salmon, and they do spread disease. The Pacific salmon, there's a great concern that they threaten the habitat here of the Pacific salmon. We have a lot of fish farms in British Columbia, and in fact, one of those fish farms is currently being occupied by British Columbia Native people, First Nations, in protest over fish farming. They are saying that what we should do is move to what they call dry land fish farming. Essentially, they move it onto land, and if they escape, they don't get into the waterways. So this has given impetus to that movement. In the meantime, there's at least one First Nation here in British Columbia that says they're already catching some of these fish. So the invasion is on. And, yeah, they're joking aside, it's a serious issue.
Yeah, I saw one protester use the phrase, invasive species do not recognize borders. And that's happening here and in British Columbia as well. Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun, thanks for catching us up on both those cross-border issues. Good to talk with you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
In response to that escape, the farmed Atlantic salmon escape, by the way, Washington State has issued a moratorium on new permits for net pens of the kind that these fish escaped from. More of KOW's The Record coming up in just a moment. So there we were just a moment ago, Vaughn Palmer and I talking about, before talking Atlantic salmon, we were talking about history and race and the relationship between white people and indigenous people in Canada. Well, here is a story touching on that complicated relationship here in the United States. A Seattle family finds out that what it has is sacred to somebody else. Here's reporter Ann Dornfeld from KUOW's Race and Equity team.
When Bruce Jacobson moved to Seattle in the 1980s, he fell in love with the Pacific Northwest. He wanted to express his appreciation with a piece of Native art. He found just the thing at a gallery in Pioneer Square, a Chilkat robe.
I just thought it was so beautiful, and it was like nothing I had seen before.
It was a 6-foot-long blanket, hand-woven out of mountain goat fur.
It's a completely symmetric pattern of geometric shapes and also shapes that come from the culture. And then it's just perfectly made. You can see no seams in it at all.
The tribe or clan it came from isn't clear, but it would have been made around the turn of the century by the Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian peoples of Alaska and British Columbia. Jacobson bought the robe and hung it on his dining room wall. His 19-year-old daughter, Sarah, grew up eating family dinners beneath the Chilkat robe. She never thought much about it. Then she saw a picture of a strikingly similar robe in her high school art history class.
The teacher told us how it was used in some kind of spiritual ceremony for the tribe, something about like supernatural and like shape-shifting. And I started to wonder why we had it in our house when we're not Native American.
Sarah Jacobson says she asked her dad a few questions. Bruce Jacobson calls that an understatement.
I felt like I was on the wrong side of a protest rally, basically, with terms like cultural appropriation and sacred ceremonial robes and completely inappropriate in terms like that.
I feel like in our country, there are so many things that white people have taken that aren't theirs, and I just didn't really want to continue that pattern in my family.
Well, I got defensive at first, of course. I said, oh, come on, Sarah, this is like more of the political stuff that you all say these days.
But Jacobson decided to investigate. He emailed experts at the Burke Museum, which has a huge collection of Native art and artifacts.
Well, I got this very eloquent email back that said, we're not going to tell you what to go do. But then they confirmed what Sarah said, that it was an important ceremonial piece, that it was usually owned by an entire clan, that it would be passed down generation to generation, and that it had a ton of cultural significance to them.
Jacobson says he was a bit disappointed to learn that his daughter was right, but he and his wife now no longer thought of the robe as theirs. He asked the curators at the Burke Museum for suggestions of institutions that would do the Chilkat robe justice. They told him about the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau.
I was stunned. I was shocked. I was in awe. And I was so grateful to the Jacobson family.
Rosita Worrell directs the institute. She says the robe has a huge monetary value, but it's precious to tribes for other reasons.
It's what we call at'ul. It is a sacred clan object. Our beliefs are that it is imbued with the spirits of not only the crest itself, but also of our ancestors. And also, it unites us as a people.
Since the Jacobsons returned the robe, master weavers have been examining it and marveling at the handiwork. Chilkat robes can take a year to make, and hardly anyone still weaves them.
Our master artist said it was absolutely a spectacular robe. She said the circles were absolutely perfect. So it does have that importance to us that it could also be used by our younger weavers, you know, to study the art form itself.
Worrell says private collectors hardly ever return anything to her organization, but they're lobbying Congress to improve their chances.
We are working on a better tax credit system that might benefit collectors so that they could be compensated.
Worrell hopes stories like this will encourage people to look differently at the native art and artifacts they possess. The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute welcomed home the Chilkat robe in a two-hour ceremony over the weekend. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
If you have a Native American item that you want to learn more about and possibly return, you'll want to see the information we have on our website right now, and we are tweeting that out as well, at KUOW. Thank you for listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, we're going to get you an update on the emergency responders from Pierce County. They just arrived in Texas today to help with the devastating effects of Tropical Storm Harvey. Some of you had suggestions for other ways to help. Michelle wrote on our Facebook page, "If you are an attorney, volunteers are being recruited to assist individuals in the areas affected by Harvey. The Texas Supreme Court issued an order allowing out-of-state lawyers to practice in Texas temporarily if they are volunteering to serve victims." And Kate writes on our Facebook page, "Please don't forget charity for all the organizations who are helping the animals as well. Wings of Rescue brings dogs and cats to Paws regularly, but especially now. Paws is the Progressive Animal Welfare Society in Seattle and Linwood." And Kate says, "A plane load of animals is arriving today." Keep your suggestions coming, okay, at KUOW's Facebook page, and we'll have more updates on Harvey for you, of course, throughout the day here on KUOW. BBC News up next. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.